here, where there looks like there's something like a stream, like a linear stream of dark matter. Or, you know, we could land here where there's a dark matter void. And so depending on where we would fall here, the implications for experiments can be quite different. I'm sorry? I'm actually not sure. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay, so I mean, the reason why we care about what the local phase space is because both direct detection and indirect detection experiments depend on that. So for example, in direct detection experiments, we're looking for dark matter that's scattering off of nuclei in these underground detectors. And what you measure is the recoil energy of the nucleus after this collision. And the rate for this collision to occur depends on the velocity distribution of the dark matter near the Earth. And then similarly, for astrophysical detection, where you're looking for dark matter that annihilates the standard model products, and you're hoping to detect the annihilation products, whether or not it's gauge bosons or photons, in that case, the flux depends on the density squared of the dark matter. So if we were sitting in a dark matter clump, for example, that would affect the local density and would affect predictions for astrophysical detection. If we were sitting in a dark matter stream, that would affect the velocity distribution and hence the rate at the direct detection experiments. So in my talk today, what I want to start off with is just a general overview of possible substructure, dark matter substructure that you can see in the Milky Way halo from simulations. And then in the second part, discuss specifically a new type of velocity substructure that we have found evidence for, and then conclude with a discussion of what the experimental implications are for this substructure. Okay, so I want to organize the discussion about the dark matter substructure sort of on this plane of possibilities, where on the right are going to be structures that are fully virialized. This is dark matter that's completely in equilibrium in the halo. And then all the way on the left is going to be the possibility of the dark matter that's not in equilibrium and hasn't virialized. So on the right, we have just a smooth halo component. These are dark matter that are smoothly distributed both in velocity space and in density space. This is often described at using a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. There are lots of other possibilities, but really, you can't just write down anything, any possible velocity distribution to describe this dark matter. And that's because of Jean's theorem. So in particular, because the equilibrium phase space configurations must depend on conserved quantities, so that if you're going to write down a velocity distribution profile, it's going to can only depend on energy, angular momentum squared, or the z component of angular momentum. And so you can only write down functions of these variables. So for example, if you make the assumption that you have an equilibrium halo that is isotropic, then your option is to write down F as a function of energy. You can write it down as an exponent. So this gives you something that ends up looking like a Maxwell-Boltzmann. And this is what gives you stable configurations for the dark matter orbits in the halo. And so another thing to remember is that when you write down, let's say, a velocity distribution, it has to be linked with the density distribution, that the two aren't separate. So oftentimes in the literature, there's sort of standard density distributions that you quote, like NFW profile or iNosto profile, and then standard velocity distributions that are quoted, like the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. But in reality, whatever is actually out there, the two are going to be fundamentally linked, because once you state what F of V is, then it's related to what rho of R is through the gravitational potential. So this sort of takes us back to the 1980s, when people were first starting to figure out how to make predictions for direct detection experiments. And this was the first paper that made the point. This was immediately following Witten's paper that first suggested the possibility of detecting dark matter from these scattering processes. So this followed up, and they made the point that in order to really know what the scattering rate is, you need to know what the velocity distribution of dark matter is. And so to make, you know, just a starting assumption for this, they say, okay, well, we can see that rotation curves seem to flatten out, and that implies that the density falls off as 1 over r squared. Density of the dark matter falls off as 1 over r squared. So making the assumption that the dark matter is isotropic and in equilibrium, And using the fact that rho then goes as 1 over r squared, you can use Jean's theorem to then end up finding what f of v is. And when you do that, for these sets of assumptions, you find it looks like a Maxwellian, so just some sort of exponentially distributed profile and velocities. And this has become the standard for most direct detection work for modeling the dark matter profile. But I mean, we know that this can't be an exact solution, because in particular, now the data's gotten a lot better. You can see that the rotation curves aren't flat up until infinity, and in particular, if they were, that would mean that the halo was infinitely massive, which wouldn't make any sense. So we know that rho can't just fall off as 1 over r squared. This is a simplifying assumption. Okay, but that gives a little bit of the background about how we typically model the smooth component of the dark matter halo. Now let's consider what can happen if when we look at substructures in the halo. So now we're going to go sort of on the completely opposite extreme and consider what happens when you have dark matter streams. So dark matter streams form when you have a subhalo that's falling into the Milky Way and merging with it, and you have dark matter that's getting tidally stripped from the subhalo as it's falling in and experiencing tidal forces from its orbit around the galactic center. And the dark matter that's stripped usually maintains some kind of 1D morphology. So if you look at it in space, it actually really does look like a stream. It looks like the tail of the subhalo that's been falling in. We see evidence for these dark matter streams in simulations. So this is work that was done using the Via Lactea survey. And this is, for example, looking at the velocity distribution at a patch of the sky. And what they find is, for example, it's not just smoothly distributed. You see sort of jagged peaks. And in particular, at high velocity here, they get this spike of dark matter where you'd really expect nothing if it was just a smoothly distributed profile. And that spike is correlated with this one particular region on the sky. So this is the sky map here. So it's correlated with this one pixel there. So this really set of high velocity particles is really just coming from one region on the sky. Evidence for streams has been seen with stars. So that gives us hope that then, that these also exist for dark matter, because we expect them to be correlated. This is a map that's, I think it's a very pretty map. There's lots of streams here, but it's a little hard to see. So this is, L and B, and I've got here. So there's the really big color at the top, sort of the red and yellow bit, that's the Sagittarius stream, which is the largest known stream. But there's a couple other ones. So this little blue patch that's going this way, that one's the Monoceros stream. And then there's an even tinier one, which is sometimes hard to see on the projector, the skinny little horizontal line, and that's the Orphan stream. So there's a lot of work that's being done to study these and also to try to map out to see if there's more stellar streams that are closer to the Earth than these ones. The Sagittarius stream is probably the one that's the most impressive. It was found, I guess in the mid-1990s, and it's originating from the Sagittarius dwarf. So as this dwarf is falling in, it's getting tidally disrupted, and it's just shedding off, this stream of most likely dark matter, but what we can see now is just the stars coming from it. And so this plot here is actually showing one of the first papers with evidence of this stream. And so what they found were clumps. The blue here are different stars that they were mapping out, and this light blue is the sun. And so what they were finding were clumps of stars in different patches of the sky, and they couldn't understand why the stars were clumping in that way. But then you can plot out here, the green line is the predicted orbit of the dwarf. And so you can see that the stars seem to be clumping around regions where the dwarf is kind of in the turning point of the orbit. And now this has actually been mapped out pretty exquisitely in detail. So the data here is the black gray. So the darker the region, the higher the orbit density of the stars. And the color is the predicted path of the Sagittarius dwarf. So now you can actually, these maps are quite detailed, and you can actually see that there's several arms of the stream that they're mapping out in the sky. So, I mean, we see the evidence for these stellar streams, and the hope, but one thing that could be interesting is, if we also have dark matter streams and one of those happens to fall near the Earth, it can have pretty significant effects for experiments. So then obviously the next question is, what's the probability that we are falling in a dark matter stream? And so people have tried to characterize this using dark matter simulations. They find that the probability is pretty small, but it's not negligible. So this is from the Aquarius survey. What they find is that there's really small odds that a single stream, that the Earth is falling in a single stream that dominates the entire local dark matter density, but that there's something like a 20% chance that we're sitting in a stream that contributes about 1% of the local density. And so that may seem insignificant, but this can actually be important depending on your dark matter model and its scattering properties. So it's highly dependent on whether or not we fall in a stream, and if we do, what the dark matter properties are. As to whether or not this is something that's interesting for experiments. Okay, so that's sort of the two opposite extremes here. What I'm going to spend the rest of the talk focusing on is a middle possibility, and this is what we've been exploring in our work. So this is something, these are particles, dark matter particles in the halo that have come into equilibrium. Have sort of begun the process of equilibrating more so than the particles in the stream, but haven't reached complete equilibrium. These particles tend to be more spread out spatially than a tidal stream, but they still have really unique velocity speed behavior. And so these are sort of the bullet points that I want to emphasize over the course of the next few slides. But that we think that these debris flows are a new class of dark matter velocity substructure. That they come mainly from subhalos, material that's lost from subhalos as they're falling into the Milky Way, and that most of these dark matter particles are spatially well mixed, but they're hotter than streams, and the distribution of speeds is still interesting. But really, the thing that got us most excited about this is because this substructure is spatially well mixed, it's ubiquitous in the solar neighborhood, and so it pretty much means that. If our picture of this merging process that's going on in the Milky Way is correct, then this is pretty much guaranteed to be in the solar neighborhood and something that we certainly expect to see in direct detection experiments. Okay, so I'm going to go into more detail now just in terms of describing this debris flow and what its implications are. So to study this, we use the VLAC-TEA 2 simulation. So VLAC-TEA 2 is one of the high-resolution N-body simulations of just the Milky Way. It follows the evolution of about 1 billion particles that are about 10 to the 3 solar masses from really high Z of like 104 up until the present day. And it also has all of the information about it. It's grouped all of these particles and identified all the subhalos that exist today. There's about 20,000 of these subhalos today. And you have all of the evolutionary information about each one of these subhalos at all of these past Zs. So for any subhalo that you see in the simulation today, you know where it was at any past Z, and you also know where all of its particles were in the past. So there's really a lot of information that's stored in the public results from these simulations. One thing that's unfortunate, most of these high-resolution simulations today don't have baryons in them. That's sort of the technology on this end is just kind of getting to a point where the simulations with baryons are increasing in resolution. So that should be something really interesting to keep an eye on in the next few years. Okay, so how do we locate what we're calling debris particles in the Milky Way? Well, from the simulation results, we have a snapshot of the Milky Way at some time at higher redshift, and we have a snapshot of the Milky Way today. We also have a subhalo or subhalos that are identified in the Milky Way today. So we could go in and find where the subhalos are today. And then locate where that subhalo was in the past, because the simulation keeps all of that information and has the evolutionary tracks. Then we identify all the particles that were bound to the subhalo in the past and look at where those particles are today. So in that way, we can see where the particles end up today. So some of them will still be in the subhalo, the ones that remain bound, but others will have gotten stripped from the subhalo. And those will probably be scattered around in the Milky Way today. So actually, the way we did it was to look at what falls within the varial radius of the halo. So it's not it was because the number of particles and the computation time for doing this was quite high. So that was sort of the most efficient way of doing it. It does tend to overestimate things because you can have random particles that happen to just sort of be passing through that subhalo that aren't bound to it. We did some checks and it seemed like that was pretty negligible though. Yeah. Yeah?
So you just considered dark matter in this equation.
Yeah.
But for any matter, maybe there was a heat effect coming from dark baryonic matter. You know, there are a couple.
Yeah, equation. Yeah, yeah.
And baryonic matter dissipates, so this interaction between the gas and the
Yeah, I'm going to discuss that in a little bit more detail later on in the talk, so maybe we can come back to that point. Because I think it's really interesting, actually, to sort of take what we're seeing in these dark matter-only simulations and then see if it still exists when we start including baryons. But we can discuss that more in a little bit. Okay, so this is a movie showing, essentially, all of the debris that we located from one of these subhalos falling into the Milky Way. And the point of the movie is just to illustrate the fact that this dark matter debris that's getting tidally stripped from the subhalos sort of lands everywhere. It just kind of gets spewed out as this thing is orbiting into the center. If you note the scale, this is in kiloparsec here. So these outer regions here go out to something like 100 kiloparsecs. So you can see sort of these sort of shell-like structures out here at very large distances, but that when you go really close to the galactic center, you lose a lot of that spatial information. It just looks like there's stuff that's there, but there's nothing really terribly interesting about it.
So what fraction of the matter of the subhalo
is getting stripped off? It depends a lot on which subhalo you look at. So some halos get completely disrupted, and so they're contributing, like pretty much everything gets thrown in. This shows the fraction of the total number of particles in the Milky Way that are coming from the debris.
Okay.
And so this is as a function of the minimum velocity of the particles in the halo. This is looking at a shell from 7.5 to 9.5 kiloparsecs, so zooming in on where we, on the solar neighborhood. And so you can see that if we look at all of the particles that we're labeling as debris, that constitutes about 23% of all of the particles located in this radial shell. But that as you sort of specify the velocity and get to really high velocities, it becomes something like 80% of all of the particles in this shell at high velocities have this origin or this tidal debris from subhalos. So this becomes a really dominant effect and something that's very important when you look at the high velocity particles in the solar neighborhood. So the second thing was looking at which subhalos are the ones that contribute the most. So this is also, I guess, another aspect of your question. And we found that typically the most massive subhalos falling into the Milky Way are the ones that are contributing the most, which I guess isn't terribly surprising. It's kind of intuitive. But so what we're showing here is the number of pericentric passages of every subhalo that we found that's identified in Via Lactea.
Right.
Yeah?
Could you go back one slide?
Yeah, sure. This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the velocity of the particular particle you're looking at?
Yes.
And how do you decide whether it's part of a debris or part of a bubble?
So if part of the debris, if it was bound to something at large redshift, at any redshift in the past.
So you actually trace it back?
Every single particle that we've identified in this radial shell, we've traced back. And if it was bound to something and it's not bound to anything today, then we call it debris. If it was never bound to anything in the past and isn't bound to anything today, then that's just...
And how do you decide? Do you decide whether it's bound today or part of the... realize?
Yeah.
But then don't you bias yourself a little bit because you're looking at for the highest velocity ones using the virialized material, you would more likely to conclude that it's not bound today.
If it's for the highest velocity ones, you're more likely to believe it.
In the plot of the mean,
yes.
Doesn't your bias increase as the velocity increase for deciding whether it's bound today or not?
You're saying that if it's higher velocity ones, they're more likely not to be bound today? Yeah.
Well, also your criteria is more likely to fail.
Yeah. Wait,
the criteria
is more likely to be correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So aren't you actually underestimating a little bit this bump?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you want to define debris, right? Yeah, I mean, what this bump isn't including are, for example, really high velocity particles that are just passing through the Milky Way, or from subhalos that are so energetic they're passing through the Milky Way but haven't gotten disrupted today, right? They're just sort of passing through. In which case, yeah, I mean, then there's it depends on how precisely you want to define the debris. So we focused on this particular definition because there's certain features that arise, which I'm going to show in a little bit, from the fact that you have these subhalos from the actual orbits of these subhalos that's interesting. So that's why we focus on this particular definition. Yes?
Do you have a maximum mass for subhalos that the particles were bound to pass to call it debris?
A maximum mass? No. No, it's just whatever.
It's like picking up.
Whatever
like
the minimum mass that can be resolved by the simulation.
Some major merger in the past, then everything is.
If you had some major merger in the past?
To form the Milky Way tail.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yes, then everything would be debris, but that's not what's observed in the VLAC-TA simulation. Right? That the process is just
chosen,
from.
The simulation was chosen to be quiet.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it was chosen to be, you know, the subhalo that they chose to really sort of zero in on is the one that they think captures the properties of how the Milky Way actually developed, so it's fairly quiet. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So this plot is showing the range of the mass of the subhalos as they're falling into the Milky Way. And versus the number of passages they make at pericenter. So the smaller and the more blue the circle is, the less it contributes to the total amount of the debris flow. And then the larger and the redder, the more it contributes. So you can see like that the really big circles are the ones that correspond to subhalos with a really large infall mass, so ranging between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10. Solar masses, and subhalos that have made quite a few pericentric passages. So these are really quite large subhalos, and also if we sort of average the number of pericentric passages that all of the subhalos make, the average is around like 4 or 5. So the fact that these really big subhalos have passed near the galactic center point about 15 times is, I mean, it's quite a lot. So it makes a lot of sense, right? You have these really big subhalos, and they've, you know, passed nearby us quite a few times, and so they're actually dumping, that's why they're dumping the most stuff, between 7.5 to 9.5 kiloparsecs. In addition, if we look at the minimum distance at pericenter for these subhalos as a function of their infall redshift, you can see that the ones that dominate, so again, these big red circles, tend to have their minimum pericentric distance at around 8 kiloparsecs, sort of around there. So they're coming in pretty close to the solar neighborhood, which is why they're contributing a lot of particles there. So all of this is, you know, it's quite intuitive that you'd expect that the most massive subhalos that have made the most passages near our neighborhood should be the ones that are contributing the most. So it's nice that this kind of confirms our intuition for this. So now we take a look at the spatial distribution of all of these debris particles. And when we look at the spatial distribution, there really isn't anything terribly interesting that's going on. So this is, again, showing a video of the debris from a sample subhalo. And what I want you to focus on this time in particular is that most of the interesting structure is occurring at fairly large distances, so many hundreds of kiloparsecs from the galactic center. That's where you get things that look like these shells. But that when you look a lot closer, there really isn't anything interesting that's going on. And we see that when we map out just the spatial distribution of the dark matter of the debris particles locally doesn't have any interesting clumps or streams or anything like that. So it looks like it's fairly spatially homogeneous.
So this is small clumps that generate. So in the simulation, there are some small clumps that forms here.
Yeah. Yeah, but if we look sort of at what we're looking, right, what we're labeling as debris flow is the sum total of all of the stuff that's gotten stripped from all of these subhalos falling in. And so even if there's small clumps that are, you know, kind of floating around, sort of when we look at the sum total, it looks like it's pretty much just follows the density distribution profile of the background halo. Yeah.
Do you know what the
No, that's a good question. Yeah. Okay, so, right, so okay, if the spatial distribution doesn't look that interesting, why are we excited about this? And the reason we're excited about it is because all the interesting features show up when we look at it in velocity space. So in particular, this is all of the, essentially all the particles that we've labeled in this radial shell. The black dashed line here is all of the particles in this radial shell in the Via Lactea simulation. And the black is when we look at the separately normalized distribution just of the debris particles. And so what you can see is when you look at this subclass of particles that their speeds are peaked at very high velocities. It's not spread out. It has a really interesting shape to it. And then if we look at the distribution of all of the particles in this radial shell minus the contribution from the debris, it's the gray dashed line. So there's a lot of discussion in the literature about whether or not using a Maxwell-Boltzmann is the right way of describing the velocity distribution in the solar neighborhood. And there's been a lot of discussion as to whether or not that there's definitely offsets that are seen from Maxwell-Boltzmann when you look at the high velocity tail in these simulations. So that's essentially when you look up here. And what we're finding is essentially once we subtract out this debris contribution, what's left looks a lot more Maxwellian than what we actually see before that point. So essentially what we're identifying is essentially what's contributing to deviations from this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution along the high velocity tail.
It doesn't look Maxwellian.
Well, it's still not exactly Maxwellian, but it's getting closer to what you'd expect it to be. Yeah. Yeah, that's generally been observed from the simulations that it looks like somebody sort of sat on your peak of your gas and sort of flattened it out. By subtracting out this component, you are making the high velocity tail look better. Okay, so now you may be asking, you see a peak, but can we actually explain why is this peak at 340 kilometers per second? It seems like that's kind of arbitrary. But there's actually a really nice, simple explanation for that. It falls out of simple energy conservation arguments. So for example, this is a really, really simple schematic, but think of this as the subhalo that's falling into the Milky Way, and it makes several passes. So it falls in, this is like initial apocenter, it makes several orbits, and then final apocenter here, let's say. So really simple energy conservation argument, right? We can take the velocity that we observe of the particle at 8.5, look at the difference in the squared velocity at final apocenter, which is here, and then just look at the difference in the potential at 8.5 versus where these particles were at final apocenter. And when we do that, we find that the velocities that we expect at 8.5 kiloparsecs are roughly on the order of 370 kilometers per second, which is really similar to what we actually see in the simulation. So it looks like it's just a simple argument of the potential difference of where these particles are today from where they were initially stripped off from the subhalos that's giving you this peak in the velocity distribution. And then in addition, if we start looking in a little bit more detail.
Why is there a characteristic apocenter distance? Where did that come from?
Oh, this? You mean what? It's an interesting point. It's just we look at all of the subhalos that contribute a lot, and they all seem to be to have roughly a similar apocenter distances. I think it may just be a fact of, you know, these are subhalos that are falling in pretty close. Like I said before, right, the ones that end up contributing the most are the ones that have fallen in pretty close to the solar neighborhood. And so I think once we look at that subset, the final apocenter for all of those, there isn't very much variation.
It's just dynamical friction, right?
Yeah.
Because they, in, most of them lose their mass, emission, a lot of their mass in their initial inflow, right? So if you just look at the profile, it just goes, mass goes boom. And so that's roughly.
Oh, I don't have that plot. Yes. Yeah, we have a plot. I don't think I have it in my slides, but we have something similar to that, yeah.
That's just dynamical.
Yeah.
Hey, could you say it again?
It loses a lot of mass in the first inflow.
Yeah.
That's just set by sort of variable radius. So exactly why it's 100 versus 200, I'm not sure why.
Does it lose it exponentially?
What do you think the mass loss?
Because they only lose it as like a power bubble when you have many more outside. You won't necessarily lose all the.
No, the subhalo will lose. Even if it loses 90% of its mass, it probably lost like most of that right in the first inflow. Does that make sense? And then it's just an incremental thing. It gets like stripped a little bit. So there are plots, which you probably have in your paper.
Yeah, there in our paper. We track the mass of each of these subhalos, and you can see that most of the mass actually gets lost pretty quickly.
I believe it when you actually have two parallels that you minimize and you find that there is a characteristic.
Yeah, I mean, the arguments that we're making here are sort of, we're looking at the general properties of these subhalos that fall in, and we're looking at, you know.
I
think this argument can even be made more airtight, is what I was saying. Like, if you were to actually do more careful modeling of the. Like,
but it sounds like there should be some simple intuition for why there's a characteristic apocenter as well.
But isn't it also just the timing issue? Like, this has to be debris today, so there's, you know, at any time.
Well, but that would just go into your overall scale. It's not necessarily, right? Like, you could have just many more outside, right? As you're going in distance outside, you increase by the square of distance.
But those are probably not contributing to the central process.
Right, so I can believe that, but that should be a simple.
So I guess the eccentricity would be like huge if you want something at like 500 kpc to contribute to 10. And those orbits are possible, I think, be pretty rare. So there should be something like that.
Yeah, this is probably workoutable, I think. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so the next set of plots I want to show. Now I'm actually going to break this down into the radial and tangential velocities of these debris particles. And each of these panels here is looking at different radii. So this is looking 30 to 45 kiloparsecs from the galactic center, 15 to 30 kiloparsecs, and 5 to 15 kiloparsecs. Radial velocities on the horizontal axis and tangential velocities on the vertical axis. So let's start off sort of further away. It looks like the tangential velocities are pretty low. Radial velocities are, spread out a little bit, but you can see that as you come in closer, all of a sudden the radial velocities, there's kind of this bimodal structure, and it's peaked at larger values, so around 200 kilometers per second, plus or minus. And then when you get even closer to the galactic center, now it looks like there's a tangential bias to this distribution, and you can actually get quite a few particles that have really high tangential velocity compared to their radial velocity. And so a really simple picture for this, again, with this very basic schematic, is that when you're close to the galactic center, you're picking out debris particles that have been stripped as the subhalos are at their turning points, so where most of the velocity is tangential. As you go further away, you're picking out particles that are getting stripped as the subhalos are falling in or moving away from the galactic center, where most of the velocity is radial. And then once you move even further out from there, then you start losing this behavior. So you lose this. But in this region, so from 15 to 30 kiloparsecs, I think that's the region where most of these subhalos are falling in or coming out from here. So sort of at this point in their relative orbits. And then when you get closer, these guys are the particles that are getting stripped near the turning points of the orbits. So this is something that we're trying to understand in more detail now, because this can have some pretty interesting implications looking for evidence for these debris flows using stellar distributions, which I'm going to discuss in a little bit. Okay, so next I wanted to talk about the experimental implications for these debris flows. There's two things that I want to focus on. First one is direct detection experiments, and the second one are stellar surveys. The work on stellar surveys is still in progress, so those will be just a few slides on our vision for where we see that going. But we've worked out the phenomenology for the direct detection experiments, so this was in our most recent paper. So just as a really quick reminder, with these types of experiments, what you're looking for is, again, the dark matter scattering off of these target nuclei in these underground detectors. And in this case, the scattering rate goes as the number of dark matter particles times the velocity and the cross-section, and this is just an average here over the initial dark matter velocities. So what most of the direct detection experiments try to measure are the recoil energy spectrum, so just the essentially the scattering rate as a function of recoil energy. However, this rate is expected to be different in the winter compared to the summer, and the reason for that has to do with the relative motion of the Earth around the sun. So from the lab frame, because of the motion of the sun around the galactic center, what we see is essentially an effective wind of dark matter coming towards us. But we're also orbiting around the sun. So in the summertime, we're moving towards this wind, and in the wintertime, we're moving against it. So in the summertime, we can see much higher velocity particles than in the wintertime. So this translates into a higher flux in summer as opposed to winter. So because you see this difference in between summer and winter, you can measure essentially the amplitude of this, the difference of this variation. That's the modulation amplitude. And so then you get a plot of the modulation amplitude as a function of recoil energy. So if an experiment can run long enough, so over the span of a year or more than 1 year, they can potentially measure this modulation amplitude. And that can be a really powerful tool for distinguishing a dark matter signal, let's say, from a background. But there's very few of these direct detection experiments at this point that are stable over long enough periods of time to be able to get this modulation spectrum. At this point, I think there's only two. Both of them have claimed anomalous results, but they're really highly debated, and there's a lot of controversy around them. Okay, so going back to the spectrum of possibilities, let's now just take a quick look at what you'd expect each one of these cases to give you for direct detection experiments. So the first case, remember, was the smooth halo. This is just standard Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution where your dark matter is in complete equilibrium. So in that case, when you calculate the recoil spectrum, you just put in here, you know, your exponential. And when you solve that out, your recoil spectrum is just falling exponential in terms of energy. And so this is what you'd expect for standard assumptions, that your recoil rate is just a falling exponential distribution, which dictates where an experimentalist would go to look, right? This is telling you, oh, I really want to look at low recoil energies to try to look for this dark matter signal. Now, in contrast, let's consider the case of dark matter streams. If you remember, the dark matter streams have coherent velocities. And so you can just put, it's essentially just like putting a delta function in this integral. When you put the delta function in the integral, what you get out is a Heaviside theta function. And so your recoil spectrum in this case just looks flat until there's a drop-off that's determined by the velocity of the stream and the particles of the properties of the dark matter particles. It depends. Yeah, most of the ones that are going to be important are going to be the ones that are at really high velocity, so near the escape velocity, so 400 to 600 or something kilometers a second. Yeah. And you can, so one thing to see from this is that the expectation of what you'd see is quite different from what you'd expect in the other case. And in particular here, you'd expect to get a lot more scattering at much larger recoil energies. So an experimental strategy that's focused on just looking at low energies may not be the best if you also have this possibility. Okay, and so now what do we expect for these debris flows? How much time do I have? Because I'm trying to figure out how quickly I should. Like 15 minutes. Okay, so I guess I'll try to explain this on the slide, but let me know if you have, I don't know how clear this is, so let me know if you have any questions about this. So we were able to just put together a semi-analytic model for the velocity distribution of these debris flows. So we can write this down as just being the velocity distribution is 1 over number of particles in the debris flow times the velocity distribution of these particles, which we can rewrite like this, where this cosine theta e, this is just the angle between the velocity of the debris and the in the galactic frame and the Earth's velocity. So what we find is that the distribution is uniform in cosine theta e, and so we can just write this out, as this. So if nothing else on this slide makes sense, all you need to know is just we have a really simple analytic model. It gives us a really simple form for what this velocity distribution of the debris flow is, and that's just this. And so the red dashed line is our simple analytic model for what we'd expect for the differential rate. And the black is what we measure, just with what we get from the Via Lactea simulation when we look at the debris flow. So the it's a really simple model, but it seems to capture the general behavior of what we're getting from the simulation. So it gives me confidence that the assumptions that have gone into this are fairly robust. That's time, because it's dependent on the time of year. Okay, so you can see here essentially that you expect to get differences in shapes depending on what component of the halo you're scattering off of. And in particular, when you start looking at these unvirialized components, you start getting more scattering at higher recoil energies than you would expect if you were just looking at a Maxwell-Boltzmann component. So to think about this just more specifically in terms of, let's say, a particular dark matter scenario and a particular experiment, let's consider the case of a germanium target and a 10 GeV dark matter candidate. On the left is the unmodulated rate that you'd expect to get in an experiment, and on the right is the modulation amplitude. So the gray line is the expectation for just the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So you get the, you know, the standard exponential fall off here that you'd expect, and this is what the modulation amplitude looks like in this case. The dashed red is what you'd expect to get if you were scattering only off of the debris flow particles. So in this case, what you'd get is more scattering here at high recoil energies, and the shape of the modulation is actually quite different. So actually, right now, these two lines are what you'd expect if it was 100% debris flow and 100% Maxwell-Boltzmann. If we take the relative normalization as seen in the simulation, we get something that looks like the red line here. So it's, you can see it's sort of like an average of the two, right? And so what it seems like is this isn't going to make a big impact if you look at the unmodulated rate. I mean, if you were to measure this red line, you would really not be able to tell the difference between this and this gray line in any experiment. But where the really interesting behavior comes into play is when you look at the modulation amplitude. Because in this case, the shape of the modulation is quite different from what you'd expect to see if it was just scattering off of a Maxwell-Boltzmann component. And in particular, you're going to expect to get modulation at energies where you really wouldn't expect to get any at all if you were just scattering off of Maxwell-Boltzmann. This is just a Maxwell-Boltzmann, not using the virialized stuff from the simulation. People have looked at a comparison of the two. I mean, there's some variation, but it's not huge. I mean, it doesn't give you dramatic differences like this. So the point here is that the real test, I think, for these debris flows is going to be if you get a measurement of the modulation spectrum, because then it can really change the shape of the distribution that you'd expect in this case. And if you were to do a measurement and see more scattering, a larger modulation at these higher energies, it might be a really important indication that there's some important substructure contribution in the local neighborhood. Yeah? Oh, I think, does this answer your question? So this is the angle of the velocity of the deep debris particle in the galactic frame compared to the velocity of the Earth, okay? So the purple triangles is the distribution for the debris, and the black is the distribution of all the other particles in Via Lactea 2, not including the debris. There's a little bit of some, yeah, there's sort of first order, you can make the assumption, which is what we did in our model, that it, this is just isotropically distributed. But there does seem to be a little bit, like sort of some higher order behavior that's going on. Next slide. so the we also looked, not in a huge amount of detail, but just started taking a look at whether or not you would see an effect for this in directional detectors. So these are Mollwide, I never know how to pronounce that, Mollwide projections for the distribution of the incidence directions of these debris particles relative to the Earth. So essentially, the center here is, that's our location, and what we see here is the distribution of the particles that are kind of coming in towards us. The first row here are particles, particles between 350 and 500 kilometers per second, and the second row are the more higher velocity ones. So you can see if you look just at the subset of debris particles that there's some really interesting distribution that you see when you look out at these things in the sky in terms of their incidence angles on the detector. Now, when you look at the contribution from both a Maxwell-Boltzmann and a debris, it becomes, because this is only sort of a smaller component of that, a little harder to distinguish. But some things you can see, and we don't know at this stage whether or not this is something that can be important for experiments, is that the hot spot changes location. So this is, the hot spot for Maxwell-Boltzmann is just centered on where coming directly at us. But when you combine it with the debris flow, the hot spot is off-center a little bit, which I think you can see from these plots. Now, whether or not that's something that's actually measurable given the specs for the current directional detectors, I don't know at this point. That's something that needs to be studied in more detail. But it does seem like there could be some potential implications for directional detectors with this. Yeah, yeah. So anything in the center is something that's coming directly incident to us, yeah. Okay, so I just wanted to conclude with just a couple slides. These are just more general thoughts on something that we're starting to work on now. Just on the implications for these debris flows for stellar surveys. So the big picture here is whether or not we can look for this velocity substructure. We can find evidence for this velocity substructure when we look at stars, and whether or not that could give us some hint of what the dark matter is doing in the solar neighborhood. We've done this essentially with streams. So with streams, we have evidence for these stellar streams, and that gives us confidence that we should expect dark matter streams. Now, whether or not these streams are near us or not is another matter of debate, but just, you know, we'd expect that dark matter streams exist. So the question is, can we now look at, you know, stellar distributions and see whether or not we can find evidence for these debris flows, and then might that give us evidence that, you know, that exists for dark matter as well. And in particular, what you want to look at in this case are really old stars in the solar neighborhood, because in particular, it's these old stars that were the ones that had gotten stripped, most likely were stripped from these subhalos, and retain the kinematic information of the subhalos. And so you can study the velocity distributions of these stars and hope that it's telling you something about the kinematics of the subhalos that they were stripped from. Yeah? Well, so you'd want to pick out, that's why you'd want to pick out a certain class of stars. So you'd want to look at stars that are in the halo, so not in the disk, and that have really low metallicity. because those are going to be the really oldest ones and the ones that are most likely not to have been sort of affected by all of these things, and most likely to be the ones that originated in the subhalos. So you have these sort of tight cuts, essentially, that you're going to put on all the stars you see, and then just look at the small subclass that you think might have the same origin as the debris. And so what you want to do, essentially, is to use these really old stars as tracers for the dark matter. So there hasn't been that much work looking for studying the velocity distribution of stars. It's harder to do than looking at their spatial distribution, just because most of the surveys that are out there only can now, at this point, measure the radial velocity, but can't get the full proper motion of the stars. There is the Gaia satellite, which is going to go up soon, that should be able to do that for a really large number of stars. So that's going to be something that's really exciting. But some people have started to look for velocity substructure, even just using SDSS data. And there was some recent work, this came out in 2009, where what they did was to measure the radial velocities of these metal poor stars in different lines of sight from Segway. So as I understand it, Segway has something like 137 lines of sight. Each of these lines of sight maps out something like a kiloparsec or so square on the sky. And what they do is, in that kiloparsec or so square, they look at all of the stars. They have some expectation of what the radial velocity distribution of those stars should be from Monte Carlo. And then they just do the measurement and see if there's any significant deviation from the expectation. And what they find is something like 8 high confidence velocity peaks that they identify. So essentially 8 high confidence regions where they see a discrepancy between their Monte Carlo and the mapping on the sky. So this is one of these regions. The expectation is in gray, and what they observe is in black. So the reason why, so this is the reason why this is interesting, is that this isn't going to be something that's associated with just like a patch of stars in the sky. Because if you imagine this, each line of sight is over a pretty large area. So something like 1 kiloparsec diameter on the sky, and when you're sampling stars in such a really big patch, you're finding that there's a bunch of them that have no spatial correlations with each other, but seem to have some interesting velocity behavior associated with them. And so the authors of this study do note that they don't actually have an explanation for why this should be the case. It doesn't look like these are stars from tidal streams or anything like that because of this specific behavior. And they comment that actually they appear to have more of a sheet-like morphology than a stream-like morphology. So this has us intrigued because this is kind of the behavior that you'd expect to see for a debris flow. You'd expect to see no spatial correlations, but velocity information that's still there amongst those stars. And so what we're trying to understand now in greater detail is whether or not the predictions that we'd expect from using these dark matter simulations are consistent in any way with what they're finding with this SDSS results and what the predictions would then be for Gaia. You'd have to have a really fat stream. And there are some, they have correlated some of their detections with known streams. So that they do find, one spot of the sky where they get a detection, they can correlate that with the Monosaurus stream. But these other patches on the sky don't seem to be correlated with any of the known streams. And then I guess when they look at the distribution of the stars, it doesn't look like there's something. It doesn't look like what they'd expect from a stream morphology. Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, this is low statistics in comparison to what you're going to expect to get with something like Gaia. So it's just a hint that there might be something interesting that's there. But no. They're unknown. Yeah. They did have a follow-up study where they did they looked at the chemical composition of these stars, and they did find that it was distinctly different from background, the background halo. So that was another strong bits of evidence that this is definitely something that's coming from, has an interesting origin maybe coming from some kind of substructure, something that needs to be studied in a lot more detail. Gaia should be perfect for it. Okay, so just to conclude, I hope I've been able to illustrate through this that from work that's been done with a lot of these high-resolution n-body simulations, we're finding that there's a wealth of dark matter structure in the solar neighborhood, that the simple picture of a smooth halo may work in some cases, but especially when we look at the highest velocity particles, it looks like they have interesting origins and can lead to really interesting features in experiments. The debris flows in particular, I think, offer a unique way to search for dark matter, because they not only give you a possibility of detection in ground-based direct detection, sort of the standard type of experiment that you use for dark matter searches, but that you can also now bring in information from star surveys, so that if you were to observe something like this, let's say with Gaia, it might give you a lot more confidence and even maybe particular velocity ranges that you'd expect to see, interesting peaks or structures in your dark matter detection. So it's, I think, a unique way of being able to use two very dramatically different experiments to try to get at the same thing. Potential discovery of this would tell us a lot about the local halo, and in particular that a significant fraction is unrealized and has these distinctive phase space features. So I think that was most of what I wanted to cover today. I don't know if there were already a lot of questions, but if there's any more, I'd be happy to take them. You mean for these? I think I have this in mind. Okay, yeah, so if I'm remembering this properly, each one of these was their, what they called their class one detections, so their highest confidence detections. So these are their galactic coordinates, distance from the sun, line of sight velocity, and I think this NS, if I'm remembering correctly, are the ones that are attributed, have this behavior. So it's, this one, they think that they can line up with some of the streams. So it's on the order of 20 or so stars in each one of the detections.
So in the outer part of the tower, this, we have no Metalsin stars beyond 10 kilometers. So some of this orbits of this star can cross our local galaxy.
Yeah.
Our local star. So what is the greenhouse number of stars or the orbits that can cross this? Maybe the origin of this star, this distribution comes from the outer part of our galaxy.
Yeah, it could. That's a good point. Yeah, I don't have a sense for what that number should be, but. Yeah.
You need population. That guy should be.
Yes, it needs to know the orbit.